Accession number 9552, reel 22.
Basil Farrer, reel 22. You tell me how you trained for the motorbike.
Oh, yes. Well, I pushed it through the barracks to the other side, and behind the barracks there was a field. The field, all actually surrounded by trees, but up and down, and it was between the barracks and Hyde Park, incidentally. I pushed it there. By the time I'd gone in there, I was out of breath. Anyhow, the corporal explained. He said, well, now watch me. And he went through the motions. Two or three times. He said, you've seen that. I said, yes. He said, well, do it. And I did it. I said, right, now you've got that. Yes. He said, well, get on it. I got on it. He said, now give it a kick. I wonder what the chicken was talking about. Of course, I never handled a motorbike in my life. He meant, you know, give it a kick to start it. He must have thought I was rather daft or something. So I said, right, when he'd explained. And I was just going to give it a kick. I said, what happens then? He said, it starts. You know, so I was dafter than it starts. Oh, good. Then I was just going to give it a kick again. I said, wait a minute. It starts. But how do I stop it? He said, you turn off the gas, of course. Well, you've got to know. Right. So I gave it a kick. And it was just like a catapult. I shot forward. I was at the top of the field before I knew where I was, and instinctively I turned, you know, because I'd got to the top and there were trees. Instinctively I turned and went round like lightning. And for a time, I couldn't get that nice intermediate either. It was too fast, and then if I turned it, it'd stall. I eventually mastered that. And eventually it was going round this field, nice and nice. Went on for about a quarter of an hour or so, or I've forgotten how long, but anyhow, he eventually called me in to where he was, and I drove it to him. I'd learnt how to start and stop it. That's all. So we'll come back tomorrow, Sergeant, same time. I went back the next day, went round the field, and then he said, now I'm going to show you how to change gear. He told me how to change gear. I honestly couldn't do it now. I couldn't do anything now. And we went round the field, and I was quite comfortable. Then I could go just round the field. That was all right. He said, that's all right, Sergeant. He said, now tomorrow we'll go round Hyde Park and finish up at Marble Arch. I said, what? And then I'll give you we had to have a military driving license, you see. I said, you won't. He said, what do you mean I won't? I said, I'm not taking this thing until I know more about it. I said, I'd look a damn silly fool as RE sergeant and that stalled, and I wouldn't know anything. What was the matter with it? How to start it or anything? He said, Sergeant, he said, I was told on the phone to give you a crash course to teach you how to drive, to ride a motorbike. You can ride it, you can start it, you can stop it. That's as far as I'm going. He said, if you refuse, I've got to report it. And I said, well, I'm not refusing. I said, I'm not certainly taking delivery, because he was going to deliver the car, the blinking bike, to me the next day after going round Marble Arch. He said it would be a piece of cake. He said, we've been going round the field, that's up and down. He said, but Hyde Park, he said, you're on the level there. I said, well, I won't be when in France, though, when I land. Anyhow, when I got back to the, I got a real ticking off. He had phoned. He said, Sergeant, I understand you've refused. I said, no, I've not refused. I said, I want time. I said, obviously I can't take delivery of this machine. I know nothing at all about it. I can start it and stop it, and that's all. He said, well, Sergeant, we wanted you to be independent. He said, now you'll have to have transport. I said, well, I'm not refusing. Give me time. Let me return. But when I feel that I've got confidence, and even driving it, I'm not damn confident in this. A motorbike, I didn't say so to him. It's a damn big thing, you know. Driving these military motorbikes, I could see, if not killing myself, killing somebody else, if not myself. Especially in war conditions. He said, no, I'm sorry, but we're under orders. There's no time. And we were under orders. So when I eventually moved in France, I had to have transport. I had it. Anyhow, we were under orders, and we moved down to, where was it, Southampton, was it? I've forgotten. And we moved over to France. I think, we were still landing on the beach. This was 2 or 3 weeks after D-Day, but we were still landing on the beach.
That would be 21st of July.
Yes. Yes. But we were still bogged down in Normandy. In fact, we hadn't got Caen.
What unit were you posted to? You were in the interpreter's pool, but where were you?
I landed there, and the first night, as I've seen a picture since, I've got a picture of it there. It was Montgomery's HQ in the grounds of the chateau. I spent the first night there, in a tent. The next morning, I was posted off, and I was posted to headquarters, 8 Corps, with an officer. And our duties were very strange duties. As I say, we were bogged down in Normandy then, as early as, because the breakthrough didn't come along until, well, almost to the end of August, you know, the breakthrough. Anyhow, the jobs we were on, there was fighting all in the old area, Normandy, and whenever the British troops sort of captured a hamlet or a village, we would go in immediately after, the officer and I, and when the civilians went during the battle, they'd go either down below and in dugouts and in the woods, you know, get out of the way. They'd eventually flock back when Jerry, if they, and we'd let it be known that we would settle any claims for looting. Now, this was a psychological thing, I think, to soften the blow, because we were doing a hell of a lot of damage. I mean, we people, and I argue when people tell me we liberated France, we landed in France and we killed a lot of French people and we destroyed a lot of French property. In a part of the country where they'd been having it very, very peaceful, Normandy. It'd been occupied, but they weren't suffering there. It's an agricultural place and a beautiful place. We'd gone and smashed the place up. And I remember going through Como, which was in flames then and smoking, and the people on the sidewalk cheering us. We'd destroyed the village. Anyhow, we made not war damage, looting, because this is what happens. A soldier in the fight, he'd be in a house, you'd see something. Well, you think a shell could come and blow that to smithereens, and if he didn't take it, somebody else would. Whatever nationality, if there's some, you see. And to soften the blow a bit, you know, create a friendly atmosphere, and, of course, They would present their claims on bits of paper. Now, we didn't want to be fooled. We knew we were overpaying, but we'd have the mayor, if he was available, of the village, and the curé, you know, the pastor, whatever you like to call him, the vicar. He'd be there, and we'd say, just pass him, is that exaggerated? And they'd say, sheets? Oh, not to exaggerate, mon vieux. You know, tell the farmer. And they didn't take your sheets. What's the soldier going to do with sheets? We had umpteen frames of sheets, pairs of sheets, and dozens of pairs of sheets. And that'd be crossed off. I'd translate all this to the officer, what it was, and we'd add it up and pay them in money. We'd one or two rather... one in particular. I remember we went to one farm, and we only found a woman and a young girl there. She'd made a claim. And we went and paid it entirely. It was a small claim. And she was very surly. She didn't even thank us for the money. So I said to her, madame, vous n'êtes pas content? Vous n'êtes pas contente? On vous a réglé? I said, le veille de votre débarquement, il est descendu. Oh, I'm sorry. She was speaking French. She said, on the evening before you landed, the landings, Two parachutists, I think she said two or one, parachutists dropped in our field. My husband took them along and hid them. and the Germans were on, came straight away. Took out my husband and the parachutist and shot both. That doesn't give me back my husband. That is perfect true, yeah. Not second that. With cases like that. Anyhow, that was my job for a time, and then the breakthrough came. I think it was towards the end of August, because Paris was liberated, I think, on the 25th, 24th or 25th of August. Jerry's broken through, we broke through, and I went. Then I was withdrawn. I was withdrawn from 8 Corps, and I found I was withdrawn and attached to 21 Army Group HQ, that is Montgomery's HQ. And we went right through then. I got down as far as Vire, that's as far as I. And then we turned round at Vire, and there was Villers-Bocage, and we came up, and then it was just a question of on the run. We didn't. That was a strange thing about World War One. I marched and marched in World War One. In World War Two, I never walked more than a kilometre. I was always on either in transport. And
what were your duties with the 21 Army Group headquarters? What were you doing there?
I had very little to do. I can't remember. Not until we got to Brussels, I had very little to do, except. Oh, wait a minute. That was the headquarters, you might say the HQ, of the interpreter's pool. And I found myself attached with the officer in charge of the interpreter's pool. And I was doing sort of his clerk, if you like, in touch with all the various things. That happened until we broke through and we went up from Normandy through Caen. And when we went through Caen, half of Caen was absolutely obliterated. Incidentally, I'd been outside of Caen with 8 Corps for weeks. And when we entered Caen, apparently, we destroyed half of it, and there wasn't a Jerry in the place. Jerry had evacuated Caen the day before the bombardment. Anyhow, that's by the way. We went up, and full steam ahead. Eventually, it was the liberation. I was in what they call the liberation of Brussels. And I don't know how this officer. I was still with. I used to travel about with this commanding officer of the interpreter's pool. Where he got it from, I don't know. But I arrived with him in Brussels in a Volkswagen, a German Volkswagen, and we stopped outside. We entered Brussels. Jerry was going out to the other end, and the Palais de Justice, the dome. There's a big dome. There's smoke coming out of there, so they tried to set fire to it, which was quickly put out. It didn't do any serious damage. And we, my officer and I, drove up to the École Militaire in Brussels. We were immediately he left me in the car to go into the École Militaire, and I didn't know whether we were staying there or not, but I was immediately surrounded by the Bruxelles, you know, the people from Brussels, Belgians. And of course, being able to speak French, they got on very well. And there was a little girl in the crowd saying to her mother, "Invite la mama, invite la ce soir, invite him for tonight." So the lady invited me to dinner. I said, "Well, I don't know what I'm staying here." Of course, incidentally, we'd stopped outside the École Militaire, and there was a cafe alongside. Beer was brought out to me. That was out to me, and terrific for self. And so I said, "I don't know whether I'm staying." Anyhow, the officer came in, and we were staying at the École Militaire. That is, the military, it's like a Sandhurst. It's an officer's place, you see. And they've got swimming pool and all that kind of thing there. So I had a wash and brush up, and I'd got this address where it's quite near. I thought, well, I'll treat them, and I took along a couple of packets of fags, you know. When I got there, the table was set with all this silver and flags and bottle and wine and cigars. Well, I didn't get my and this is I thought Europe was stamped, but they were rich people. They had they had servants, and there was the kid. There were two kiddies and the wife and the husband and a sister, rather the man. And this is a peculiar thing that happened during that dinner. Air raid warning went, and I was sat next to the gentleman, the father, He turned to me, he said, asked me, he said, what do you do when there's an air raid alert? Well, of course, I didn't want to say that. I said, well, I'll do whatever you wish to do. So the kiddies joined in and said, oh, Papa, il a toujours la frousse, s'il descend en bas. Papa's always scared stiff. When there's an alert, he goes downstairs and they said, and believe it or not, it's perfectly true, he left it at the table and went downstairs in the cellar, and we continued. And when they all clear went, he came back. That's true. That's not invented. That's unbelievable, but it's true. Anyhow, that was my first evening in Brussels. And then I was became attached to what they call the Works Directorate.
That's
of
the Royal Engineers.
Of the Royal Engineers.
And duties
then we were scouring the country for timber. We'd go to different sawmills and places where there were timber, not bits of wood, but timber planks and trunks and things, because timber is in great demand for an army on the run, on the march. And that went on for some time. Of course, there's various things happened during then. I was there at Christmas time. I covered the whole of the country, that is saying, of Belgium. I was up near Nijmegen, I think it was, when that happened. I was travelling quite a lot with an officer for requisitioning for timber and so forth. And then I've forgotten the precise date, but we were going to cross over. We didn't. That winter went through. It was some time before we crossed over the Rhine, you know. And the officer in the that I was with, he said, or the service I was with, the officer there, said, "Oh, Sergeant, do you particularly want to go into Germany?" I said, "Why'd you ask?" He said, "We're going to cross." And I said, "Well, why do you ask then?" He said, "Because I've got a job for you." He said, "But if you want to go into Germany, well, of course I'll get somebody else." Well, I said, "Well, I didn't go into Germany in the First World War, and it doesn't make any difference whether I go in this. What's the job?" He said, "Well, you're entirely on your own. It's on the Franco-Swiss frontier. That's about it was a couple of hundred miles from any British troops." "Oh," he said, "you'll go down there and you'll get instructions." I said, "All right, well then." So I didn't cross, and I was given my told what it was. Now, what it was this. I'll explain straight away. Switzerland was neutral, and it would have been an infringement, apparently, of their. That this is my supposing. It's the obvious. It's the only obvious thing to me that such a thing should happen. It had been an infringement of their neutrality had they consigned goods direct to the fighting forces, the British Army. That would have been an infringement of their neutrality. That's what I assume. Because I was sent down there to a place called Pontarlier. That's right on the Franco-Swiss frontier. And there was a train after the liberation of France and all that, and things were normal. There was a train every day from Zurich to Paris. Apparently we'd got somebody in Switzerland making these purchases. And it was timber. All trunks, logs, wagon loads. They'd attach a couple of wagon loads to this passenger train that stopped at Pontarlier. I would have those two wagons taken off the train and put into a siding. They hadn't consigned it to the British Army, only as far as the Franco-Swiss frontier. And I took delivery of it. I used to phone up in the morning Switzerland, ring them up to Zurich, I think it was Zurich, and ask them whether or not, and if so, if yes, how many wagons of timber would be on the day's train. They'd tell me, and I would be there to have it taken off and put into the site. When I'd got about 30 wagons, then I would phone to a place called Dole, about 50 or more kilometres away, to have an engine sent along. And I'd do all the necessary documentation, label all the wagons, and direct it to a military depot between Antwerp and Brussels. That was my job down there. That's all I had to do. So all day long, I was free to wander in the mountains, and because there's the Jura Mountains, and it's a skiing resort. I used to go up this climb up it, of course, and I could see. It was very strange. I could look over into Switzerland and see it all lit up. See Switzerland, the village on the other side. It was Verviers on the other side of the. And it was all lit up, you know. It's a very strange thing to see a town lit up at night. We hadn't seen one for a lot, you know, in England and not in France, as far as I could. And that was very strange. Anyhow, I continued that. And I was down there when V-Day arrived. V-Day. And
how did you feel about this one? Because you hadn't felt too celebratory when after the end of the First World War. How did you feel about in Europe?
I happened to be that day in, as I say, my base where I was billeted and doing all the work was at Pontarlier. But I happened to be that day in Besançon. So everybody was, you know, wild with a bit of excitement, and I just went in a cafe, and of course I didn't know anybody, and had a drink or two, but nothing extra. It just, nothing wild. It might have been in other parts in bigger towns, but just took it in. That was that.
You felt happy about it? You felt it was more...
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so. I mean, I couldn't tell you precisely my feelings. They could have been, they could not have been. Now I could only imagine what they would be, because I didn't make a note or even don't remember. But there must have been a feeling of relief anyhow. Obviously, must have been. So they'd forgotten all about me. And so I sent what they call a signal to Brussels. Oh, that's how they told me, of course, to rejoin Brussels. So I returned to Brussels, and the precise date I've forgotten. I was in Brussels a week or so, and the demobilisation had started for a certain, according to age and service overseas. Well, my age then was 48. And I got almost a maximum overseas service. So I was, there was sort of number one, number two. I think I was the fifth lot. And I was out in very quick time. I was demobilised. Well, demobilised, I found eventually that I was transferred to the Army Reserve. Because apparently I'd enlisted as a regular soldier. Anyhow, I was sent over to England. Where did I have to go? I've forgotten where I was demobbed. Anyhow, we've reported to England and civvy suit and went to Nottingham. And that was the end of the war.
Had they maintained your post for you in the Cunard Freight Office?
Now that is a great thing, if I've time to tell you that. Naturally, I'd also got quite a lot of leave, because leave was according to service. And I'd got quite... I think it was in, when would it be now? July. Was it June or July? I've forgotten, really, when I was demobbed. But I got right till October leave. So a couple of months, quite two or three months leave. Now, my boy, at that time, he was an architectural student. And they were with his mother in Diggs here in Nottingham, and he was an architectural student. He was just finishing the period, just about finishing, nearly.
He was presumably bilingual.
He's bilingual, yes. Properly bilingual, that is to say, the first language he spoke was French. He spoke French before he spoke English. Strange to say, but that is so. He speaks. I mean, when French people hear him, they can't believe that he's English. He has an accent, but the accent he's got Parisian, because as in this country, there are accents according to the region you're in, and the Parisians have them. You can be told he's a Parisian accent and pure, whereas I speak fluent French but with a slight English accent. However, I thought, now I'll take a fortnight's holiday We did. We went to Llandudno for a fortnight, my wife and the boy. We had a fortnight. And I thought, now I'll report to Liverpool, because they were in digs there, and the boy hadn't finished his studies. So wherever I was, I couldn't take them away. They'd have to stay here. So I thought, now, I've got my army pay, and if I get back in the Cunard, I'll have sort of double pay. So I reported to Liverpool. I met with a rather frosty reception. Well, no, very pleased you came through, Mr. Farrer. Of course, we're not opened yet in Paris. I said, yes, I'm well aware of that. He said, well, we'll let you know when we open. I said, but I've come to report for work. Ah, but you're Continental staff. No, I'm Continental staff for MQ. No, you're Continental staff. And this was the personnel manager. I said, well, Mr. White, his name was Mr. White. And, Mr. White, what are you telling me? You're telling me to find another job meanwhile? He said, well, that would be a solution. I said, wait. I said, at my age? I said, but I'm Cunard. Not exactly. As a matter of fact, I must tell you, Mr. Farrer, that you're not the only... They're all coming back, our people who were in the service, they're coming back, and we are obliged by law to take them back. I said, well... I said, yes, but... I said, I was told by Mr. Cunard that my job was there. He said, it is there when we open up in Paris. I said, but Mr. Whitehead, you don't consider me Cunard. You're not really Cunard. You're Continental. I said, Mr. Whitehead, you wrote to my wife in 1940, reminding her that if... that was the case. Now, I must tell you this. Cunard, Mr. Cunard, Tony Cunard, they make my money up. Now, in France, half my money was what they called the share, that is, allowance for cost of living allowance. When I got to England, my wife wrote to me to tell me that she was receiving no money from the Cunard. I got in touch with them, and they pointed out, but your army pay exceeds your civilian pay. I said, what do you mean? I said, yes, but that was cost of living allowance, and we've no cost of living allowance in England. So my wife received nothing. And they reminded her that if I had to remain on the superannuation fund, because I was on the superannuation fund of the Cunard line, she must send the monthly contributions, which she did throughout the war. So I reminded Mr. Whitehead of this peculiarity. I said, you reminded my wife that if I had to remain on the superannuation, she must send the monthly contributions, which she did, and I'm on the Cunard superannuation fund, therefore I'm Cunard, aren't I? Oh, you're on the superannuation. Oh, he'd overlooked that. Oh, right, Mr. Farrer. Well, that also stinks. Now, you go home and we'll send you a letter. We'll write to you. And they made me wait until October. Before I left, he said, well, by the way, you're on leave till when? I said, 15th of October. I got a letter on about the 10th or 12th of October telling us to report at Bristol on the 15th. I didn't have double money on. That's how I was treated with the Cunard. So much so that I retired 25 years ago. In 1960 I retired, 26 years ago. I paid superannuation to the Cunard during all that time, 5% of my salary. I receive £60 a month from them now. My salary is not index linked. £60 a month. I got an increase about last year, or early this year, I've forgotten. £2.50 a month. I wrote and told them. I said, less value than a shilling when I was contributing towards what I expected to be an adequate pension in retirement. It's nothing I can do about it. Cunard was taken over by Trafalgar House, and so I'm out. That's extraordinary, isn't it?